the Swenson Immigration Swedish Immigration Center today on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Immigration is in the headlines these days, but Swedish immigration is a daily affair here at Augustana. We'll hear about that on Scribble. Jill Seaholm, how did you happen to get locked up with Swedish immigration?
Well, it helps to be 100% of Swedish extraction.
Is that a real requirement?
No, but it sure helps, and it comes in very handy, I can tell you that. My parents were into genealogy long before the Swenson Center existed, I could say. We opened in 1981. No, not that I was there at that time, but... my parents were a big influence on my interest in family history.
Mm-hmm. And how did you link up with the Immigration Center?
Well, even before I was an Augustana student, my mother had been a volunteer at the Swenson Center, helping them index things onto cards, which is how it was done back then. And then I became an Augustana student and decided to study Swedish because my parents had taken me and my brother to Sweden in the early 1980s, and I was hooked, and I had to take it farther. And there were openings for students to work at the Swenson Center, and 1985 was my first time there. We were in the attic of the Denkman building on campus, the old, well, it was then still the library of the college, mm-hmm. the Denkman Library.
What's your position now?
My title is Head of Genealogical Services, which I discovered is spells hogs. But it's my we all wear a lot of hats there, and I actually do way more than genealogy. I oversee it, but I also end up doing a lot of administrative duties.
We need to back up a little and have you describe what the center is. It's probably the only thing on campus that is better known around the world than it is, right, at Augustana College.
You may be right. There are other things on campus named Swenson, so sometimes people are directed to those places first. We were founded in 1981 as a center to collect and promote the study of Swedish immigration to North America. Glenn Brolander, some of you might know that name from Augustana history from the 1960s and 70s. It was his idea to start us, and he approached Berger and Lyle Swenson. And Berger had been the chief of the Augustana Book Concern, and he persuaded them to fund it, at least the beginnings of it. So in 1981, we opened in half of the upstairs of the Denkman Library.
What exactly do you do at the Immigration Center?
Well, lots of things. I always like to joke that I run the place, but we do have a director. You mean me personally or in general?
Well, the center? What happens there? I mean, we brought you on here because we are interested in any reading and writing and research and publishing and so on.
Okay.
So I imagine that you receive a lot of letters, people seeking information.
Nowadays, emails, but yes, indeed. In the beginning, we collected books and archives and diaries, personal papers and things, and a lot of scholars have come over the years. We strive to be and are an academic research library, but scholars have been coming to us for decades using our materials to write their PhD theses and dissertations, and we also bring in a scholar once a year using it's not a fellowship anymore, we call it a research award. They can come in and use our records on site, and we give them a little bit of a stipend or reimburse their travel expenses. But people have been using us to write books and articles. We also publish a quarterly magazine called Swedish American Genealogist, and we're not the editors of it. The editor is a woman in Sweden, actually a well-known Swedish genealogist, but we are the publishers, and people can subscribe to it through us and also tack on memberships to us. But we do answer a lot of queries and send letters back to people and write articles occasionally ourselves for this quarterly and other quarterlies. And we have a substantial website telling about the records that we have and what people can use and how they should contact us to use them.
You say collect records. Where at the beginning did you collect records from?
Well, in the beginning, we inherited several things from the college's collections. We were founded in 1981, but the college has been around since 1860, and their special collections and library, some of their collections lent themselves better to what we started to collect. So we inherited some of the college's book collections, particularly things that are very much in Swedish. Not to say that all of our things are in Swedish. I think maybe only about 40 to 60% are. But that's how it started, and then word spread that we were looking for things, and people would donate their diaries and old family letters. And
do you, when you get things like that, do you go through them? Do you look through them and see, and maybe find a way to catalog or organize this so you know what you're looking for?
Yes, I have a coworker who's an archivist who does that with archival donations. But yes, we have to make sure that we don't already have several of the same thing that people are offering us. Space is a concern, so we do look at things and try also to get a good mix of things that are not necessarily all one type of letter from the same decade, for example. From Sweden to Illinois, you know, we want a good mix of things for that have come to around the U.S. I mean, we try to be a Swedish National Archives in the U.S., Swedish American Archives. So we try to collect things about the whole U.S., Swedes and the whole of the country and Canada too.
So how large is the collection? Like how many manuscripts, letters, books?
Boy, my coworker could tell you in linear feet. I think we say book-wise around 20,000. Wow. And the books are cataloged largely. Most of them are done being cataloged, and you can search Augustana's library catalog to see the titles and things. And we participate in interlibrary loan, so people around the U.S. can search the library catalog online and request things through their home libraries and have them sent out to them. Archives-wise, I just don't have a sense of that in my head, but you can look at our website to see. There might be.
But it's growing. People are still donating things?
People are still interested in preserving their things in a place like ours where they'll be able to see them again someday, or their kids may not be interested just yet, but they want them to be.
Do you ever buy documents, or must they donate them?
I can't think of a time when we've ever had to buy something. It's donated. People do offer to sell us things, and we just say that we don't have a budget for it, which is true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is there a fair amount of translation involved? I mean, you know, if people write you from Sweden or and want to, I mean, do you translate?
Yes, I mean, people figure that we probably can speak Swedish, so they'll write to us from Sweden in Swedish, and we do have one of our pages on our webpage is in Swedish for those people looking for lost Americans in the U.S. We also offer translation service, so people can send their old letters to us, and we'll try to make an estimate for them, and they can hire us to do it. We charge by the hour.
What moves you to publish something?
Well, it might be something we haven't seen published before. Specifically, what I think of is the quarterly that we publish, Swedish American Genealogist, and that's what I'm kind of constantly on the lookout for articles to put in. And I'll usually someone who will come into the Swenson Center with an interesting story, I'll say, you really need to contact the editor about this, and maybe she'd like to have you publish this story in SAG, as we call it, Swedish American Genealogist. So that's the kind of thing. But also anything that might bring to light the Swedish immigration to North America, specifically the mass migration period of 1850 to 1930, that's where we focus. That's where our collections focus.
So if someone wanted to, I'm assuming that much of your work is genealogy.
A good chunk, yes. A lot of we are an academic research library, but so many of our records lend themselves to genealogy that is our primary business, if you want to call it that.
What do you do now in this non-letter writing age? Are you afraid that, or are you even interested in records from this period of time?
Well, I mean, like I said, we focus on the 1850 to 1930 time period, the historical immigration. So that's primarily what we do, although someday we may have to move forward more. Records, there's a, what they call a privacy law. You're not allowed to publish things about living people. So there's a certain number of years, like copyright, 72 years or something. You're not supposed to go closer to the present than this set of years. So we're probably always going to be looking at historical things. But it is a consideration that, you know, should we be collecting Swedish websites and Swedish American text from websites and things like that are not tangible.
So if I had a great-grandfather who came over, I know, sometime in the 1850s, and I think it was to Ellis Island, could I find out from you where that might be?
Well, the first thing I'm going to say is that Ellis Island didn't open until 1892.
Well, that shows
that. That shut you down.
Yeah. Okay. But
let's say 1893 then.
Okay. Well, that's just one source, though.
Yes.
So, yes, we have several databases we could look in. It depends on what you're trying to find out about him, and that's one of the first things we'll want to know from you so we know where to start looking. But we would start in some databases of people leaving Swedish parishes, leaving Swedish ports. We also have one of our primary sources over the decades has been Swedish American church records, and those have been on microfilm for since the 70s and 80s, even before we were founded. And if people joined these churches, it's supposed to theoretically say where they came from within Sweden, and that's the gold mine that people are looking for.
Are you digitalizing now, or?
A lot of these things are not ours to digitize. We don't own them, but many of the entities that do own them are working on it. Yes, so slowly things are ending up online.
Yeah. Do you do work for people? I mean, if they say, I want to find out, you know, what my roots are, can you help me locate my parents, grandparents, and so on? Do you do things like that?
We do. We do research for hire for people. We have a website, and people can go there and print out what we call a research request form and send it to us, or they can fill it in. And we still prefer print right now. So then people can mail payment with us with it, and it tells them how much to send and things like that. But we kind of grill them about what they know and what they want to know. And it's the same. People can also come to visit us and see our records. We go by appointment, so they can come in and we'll help them through using the records. But we will want to grill them over the phone about what they already know and what they're trying to find out, and just make sure that they're not wasting a trip if we don't have what they think we have, or if they don't have enough yet to start a search. And it gets them to organize their information before they come in.
Yeah. I remember my father once, I discovered traveling with him. He was a dining car steward, and he asked if I wanted to stop off on the city of Miami in Birmingham and visit some relatives. I said, I didn't know we had relatives in Birmingham. He said, well, we're not strong on kin, but apparently there are a whole bunch of family people I'd never heard of before. Mm-hmm. But now there seems to be an intense interest in genealogy.
Mm-hmm.
People want to know where they came from.
Yeah, yeah, it's very popular. I say that since the internet came out, it's been growing in popularity, but TV shows like Who Do You Think You Are on, I guess it's on TLC now, and You're Finding Your Roots with Henry Louis Gates on PBS. Those shows with Ancestry.com is their main sponsor. You see Ancestry.com all over the place and their commercials, and it's just everyone knows about it now.
Does DNA research factor into this?
Well, not so far. We're not scientists. We're in the archives business, but it certainly comes up a lot, and we read about it a lot and see a lot of the people that we encounter have done their DNA and are trying to prove things, prove connections that they've made through it. Mm-hmm. So,
is your work expanding, holding steady, or what?
It's ever-evolving, I would say, but yes, expanding into different things. About 10 years ago, I started leading a trip to Salt Lake City to show people and to have them use the Swedish parish records and other Swedish records that are on microfilm and now getting ever more digitized.
Why Salt Lake City?
Because the Mormons over the decades have been microfilming all of the records around the world. They've been going into courthouses and churches and you name it, and microfilming, at least back then, I suppose as early as the 30s and 40s. They're, I believe, supposed to submit 3 or 4 generations each. Mm-hmm. More church member is supposed to do that. So they have made these records more accessible to them, and they've been indexing them for years and years.
So you can access that from here?
Much of it you can now. They have a good website now called familysearch.org, and it's a free one, completely free. You just have to sign up for it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is fascinating because I see these ads for DNA studies and so on, mm-hmm. and my mother used to say, you don't want to look too far back up the family tree. You may find someone hanging from one.
That's right. Or you may find something you didn't expect or not find something you did expect.
I was terrified because one of my nieces did some work and sent me the result. And it looked as if I might be distantly related to Newt Gingrich, and I was appalled.
Charlemagne. Everybody's right. Supposed to be descended from Charlemagne.
No, everybody was an Indian. I have an Indian princess in my mail. There were no Indian princesses besides that.
My wife is traced all the way back to John Alden and Priscilla Mullen.
Oh,
wow.
Yeah, so I can't say anything. Well, I had an uncle who was a bank robber.
The center will not be of much use to you.
Bank robber.
I think having an uncle who tried to be a bank robber is a fascinating thing to have in your family.
My own background is very dull compared to... Yes.
Oh, well, Jill, it sounds as if you spend each day dwelling in the past, but in a very exciting way.
Thinking about dead people, yes. Yes.
Jill Singholm, who's with the Swanson Swedish Immigration Center, was our guest today. And we thank you very much, Jill, for coming to visit us.
It's been my pleasure.
And with that, we'll dash over to the book bag. Being Norwegian, are you kind of left out in the cold with the Swedish Immigration Center?
No, I can be the bad boy, right? I'm the Illinois State President of the Troll Underground. It's a Norwegian resistance group.
I see.
Designed to keep doll horses out of people's homes.
Well, you know, that's why you were given a desk in the basement.
Yes, it is. It's the troll hole.
Yeah, the troll hole.
You know, what's interesting to me is that from my own experience, the third generation, I forget what historian suggested that the third generation has the most interest in their roots of any generation. Mm-hmm. And that certainly is true with both Margaret and me. We were, especially Margaret, really interested in tracing our roots. Who was this and who was this and who married this person and so forth. Our kids, fourth generation and fifth generation grandkids, could care less.
In our whole family, my older sister, who's now 97, has seven grown kids. And one of them is a genealogist. And boy, does she do work.
Well, what's happened is that it hasn't died out, right? Mm-hmm. You mentioned it, because of DNA and these programs about tracing your roots and stuff, I was glad to hear Jill say it's as alive and well as it's ever been.
Yeah. Well, it is, but I don't know. You look back at the past, and I think I'm not sure what that tells you about yourself, if anything. I'm interested in colorful people. Uncle Dick Wooten. I don't know if we're related or not. All the Wootens, we come in chocolate and vanilla varieties, but they all go back somewhere, and mostly to England, but I know they have roots in Sardinia, France, and so on.
Wow.
Yeah, it's interesting, but it's not absorbing to me. It's fascinating. That people are born and people die, and quite frankly, we're all forgotten.
Right.
After three generations, who knows who was and what they did, and who cares unless you're a mass murderer or a great dictator or a great writer, a saint or a sinner. Unless you've made some kind of indelible remark, good or bad, you're just gone.
Except for those people that I think genealogy is one of those things you could really get hooked on.
Mm-hmm.
And you can spend hours and take trips around the world trying to trace down one ancestor.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it you're rabid about it, I think, if you're really into it.
On one of our London trips, my older sister went along, and she was charged by her daughter to go to this churchyard
right. In
London and look for this headstone.
Right.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I have nothing on the past, but something very much on the present. There's a new book out by Robert Bernard Reich, called The Common Good. You'll remember him because he was almost dwarfish, really short guy. And he served as Secretary of Labor from 1993 and 1997, and he served in government posts under Presidents Ford, Carter, and Clinton, his most distinguished roles under President Clinton. But when he was young, being very short, he was the victim of bullying, just a lot of it. And he sought the protection of some older boys. And one of them, interestingly enough, was Michael Schwerner.
Oh.
One of the three victims of the Ku Klux Klan in 1964. He was one of the three young men who went down to help register African-American voters. And he has always had a deep interest in the common good. He points out that right now there's an argument as to whether or not there is such a thing as a social contract. You look at business, and it came out of the Harvard School of Business that the only thing that corporations were to worry about is increasing returns to shareholders, and later on it got to be no matter the cost. Didn't matter about the workers or the communities they were in or anything else. And that is a change, because we used to have a pretty good sense of a social contract, and now there is this big divide, and we've seen political polarization, but also racial polarization, ethnic polarization, and it's not what this country was designed to do. And he wants to bring us back to a basic argument of democracy versus tyranny, because if you can't have democracy, it will yield to tyranny. And his question is there such a thing as a social contract? The enemies of the common good seem to be all over the place. from the well-heeled financiers to slumlords, deregulated
banks.
They've
always been there, however, right?
They've always been there, but they have been under some constraint, but apparently all the constraints are off. And he argues we ought to go back to that. I don't think you're going to find ironclad solutions in this book, but it's good to read to come back to that idea of a social contract. What do we owe one another? Do we owe other people anything? So it's The Common Good by Robert Reich.
Well, if we could talk with each other, you know, instead of argue and debate, and we might be able to come to some conclusions.
I have found, you know, I get inflammatory emails from people
right.
when I write, even on
right.
the most anodyne
right.
topics.
Right.
I answer in the most reasonable terms I can think of. And quite often I'll get an answer back. And it's amazing how the tone of everything
right.
softens as we begin to exchange.
I mean, I think it can be done.
Yeah. I can talk to anyone. I can talk to anyone, no matter how. I know I am friends with some people who are polar opposites to me in every facet of my life. We can still talk. We can still be friends. But trying to establish some sense of the things that bind us together seems to be more and more difficult. You have any fast recommendations?
I have a very quick one. Since we, a couple of weeks ago, we had Reggie McLeod on, the editor of Big River, there wasn't time talking to him to talk about a book that's just come out about 6 months ago from the University of Wisconsin Press called The Driftless Area. And it's a huge anthology of poems and stories and essays about that driftless area, which is the area that essentially Big River covers. Mm-hmm. So if you have any interest in the people, the geography, the history, the landscape of the driftless area, this would be a good anthology to pick up.
You know, if I were a better walker, I'd go up there this summer just to look around. Because we've talked to people who've written about the driftless area, and we've talked to Reggie a
right.
couple of times now about that region, and I've read about it, but it sounds absolutely fascinating. And I suppose when you go up there, you say, well, it's just land, you know, it's plants.
Well, it isn't.
Rocks,
there's something
so
about the bluffs that,
oh,
that
yeah.
I haven't bothered to try to put my finger on, but it is a haunting.
It is.
Landscape.
And the fact that it is so old, it predates the Ice Age, and the Ice Ages never touched it.
Well, it turns out that at the top of the bluffs, there is now glacial till. How did that get there, right?
Yeah, but
it
only touched around the edges.
Yeah, on top of the bluffs, right in the heart of the driftless area, there is glacial till.
Oh, yeah, one of the very early glaciers did go over, but the last.
So they, you know, they didn't miss all the glaciers. Anyway, no. It's a fascinating book, and about a really fascinating area.
Now, what's it called?
The Driftless Area.
Okay, and we'll take a look at that, and we'll take a look at our schedule. And I see we're due back next week. So
okay,
and that means you are too. We hope that we'll see you for the next session of Scribble.